Good morning, everybody. Are you well? So my wife, the lovely Louise, did explain that she started a bit of a talk last week. How many of you were here for last week's talk? I was, but I was in kids' church, so I had to listen to it on the recording. If you do want to see it, or hear it, I should say, then go onto the church website because you will hear it on there. And as she quite rightly said, it is really entitled, Do You See What I See? Do You Hear What I Hear? Do you know what I know? Because there are so many characters in the Christmas story, the Nativity, that if we can, just for a moment, put ourselves in their shoes, I think there are a lot of questions going on. Do you agree? I know it's very easy for us in primary school mode to read the passage and go, yeah, we know how it ends. They were living it. And they were living it event by event, chapter by chapter, not knowing how it was going to unfold. So Louise last week spoke specifically about these questions. What do we think Mary heard? What do we think Mary saw? What do we think Mary knew in the Christmas account of how it all unfolded? That was last week. It was Mary's perspective. Today, I'm going to kind of pick up, not where she left off as such, but do the same kind of thing. Look at the same passages in many cases. Same questions. Do you see what I see? Do you hear what I hear? Do you know what I know? Love, Joseph. So, Luke chapter 1, starting in verse 26. I'm going to read this. It is on the wall behind me, as you can see. This is how the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph. But before they came together, she was found to be pregnant through the Holy Spirit. Because Joseph, her husband, was faithful to the law, and being a righteous man, he did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. Now, let's just pause there for a second, because I think it's important for us to look at the slight contradiction in what we've read already. It says they were pledged to be married, but then he's referred to as her husband. Have you noticed that? Now, in society today, we use this term, they're engaged, or a fiancé, meaning that there's been a ring, probably, and there's been a proposal, there's been an acceptance, obviously, and then the wedding, which might happen a year later, 2 years, or even weeks later, depending on how quickly you want to actually get married. It's the wedding that is the union. Would you agree? That's the bit that's legal. That's the bit that we all celebrate and put a posh dress on and whatever else. But in Jesus' time, as we come to this story with Joseph and Mary, weddings and marriage were much more of an affair that took time. You see, the order went like this. A man and a woman would either be arranged by their parent. Again, that's a traditional view in biblical times. Or there would be genuinely attraction and love. Then at some point, the man would approach the girl and say, would you marry me? And also approach the family and say, would you allow your daughter to marry me? And of course, those of us gentlemen today, we may have got down on one knee to the lady of our dreams and asked them to marry us. And then chivalry kicks in and we go and speak to the father and say, would you give me your daughter's hand in marriage? Is that what happened, Matthew?
No.
That's what happened with my proposal, can I just say. I did get down on one knee, and I did approach Charles, Louise's dad, and said, would you allow your daughter to marry me? He reluctantly said yes, but that's another story. But genuinely, in biblical times, you see, after the acceptance, there was at least a year of, a word we're not enjoying at the minute, negotiation. Now, slightly more negotiation probably than Brexit, but that's another story. But genuinely, there would have been a 12-month period after which the bride and the family said yes, but the negotiations were around payment for the woman, because there was this thing called dowry, where the man had to pay the family some amount of money and some portion of his income in accordance to what they felt their daughter was worth. Now, that was not just a, I'll give you a camel, and then she can come and live with me. It actually was a very protracted process where there would be negotiation backwards and forwards, because it wasn't just about a quick payment. There would have been discussions of ongoing payments. What would happen if the man, who was of course the provider of the family back then, if the man was to die early, how was the woman going to be taken care of? And all of this was written down with agreements with the family. That was a one-year process. Now, that is where we find the story right now. That's why we have pledged to be married. There had been the agreement. And technically, he was considered as her husband, even though they'd not finished negotiations. Are you with me? So we've got to keep that in mind. Because there was a commitment, it was not a sexual, consummated relationship yet. That's what happened after the ceremony, which would be at the end of that year. The ceremony, by the way, was a very ornate thing where the whole of the community would have got involved. It was over a week long. But in this year, where the commitment had been agreed, but there was no consummation of the relationship, she gets pregnant. And if we, not just blokes, but if we ladies as well, can put ourselves in the position of, I've committed to you, we've agreed to be married, and in the community's eyes, you're calling me husband, even though we're not acting and living together as husband and wife just yet, she's been with another guy. And I think we need to be honest and say, Joseph would have felt betrayed and hurt and ashamed and embarrassed, and the whole community would have been talking very badly about him, thinking either he's been doing things that are outside of the law, ungodly behavior, he's been sleeping with her before the wedding, because that's what would have been assumed, you see, of course. And he knew that that wasn't the case. So his gut reaction was, who is this other guy? Now let's pick up the story. Joseph, her husband, was faithful to the law. That's not an insignificant statement, by the way. He was faithful to the law. He was a righteous man, and he did not want to expose her to public disgrace. He had in mind to divorce her quietly. But after he had considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. All of this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him, but he did not consummate their marriage until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. The assumption was that she was an adulteress. She was pregnant, not by Joseph, and as far as he would understand, before this dream, not by any supernatural method, by natural methods with some other bloke. And when it says about him being faithful to the law of the time was that adultery, and that's what it would have been, adultery, unfaithfulness, that would have been punishable by death. And he was totally within his rights to stone her. And the community would have joined in, as we know in other stories in the Bible. Now, the interesting thing is this, he didn't. What do you think that says about the integrity and character of Joseph? He could have, and the norm would have been, to have shunned her and had her stoned to death as an adulteress. He chose not to. Why? Well, the story does tell us that he was faithful to the law, but he was also a righteous man. Righteous means he was keen to do what God would approve of, not necessarily what was the easy option, the quick option, or the popular option. Now, the first question I want us to look at, as I mentioned with the topic and the title of this talk, is, do you hear what I hear? Let's put ourselves in the shoes of Joseph and think about what he heard in this. So here's a piece of this passage, starting at verse 20. Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. The first thing that is almost in the title of this angel encounter, it's not just, yo, Joseph. It's, yo, Joseph, son of David. Why is that significant? Because back in Matthew chapter 1, and in Isaiah, the Messiah was going to come from the line of David. And we're talking about lineage. In Jesus' case, all of the prophets had said, he is going to be born in the line of David. And then Joseph is identified within the first few words of this angelic encounter, Joseph, son of David. That is really interesting. Because we know biology. The scientists and the doctors in the room, we know biology. We know how genes are passed on. Was Jesus biologically Joseph's? Of course not. No. Joseph was not the paternal father of Jesus. Yet, God considered Jesus to be in his line. That, I think, is an indication. It's like a little picture of the way that God adopts us into his family. God considers Jesus part of David's line because of his father figure, not his biological father. That means surely Joseph was not an accident in the story where Mary was chosen. If anything, it's the other way around. Joseph was the one that had to be from the line of David, and Mary happened to be a willing fiancée. Let me say that again. We give Mary lots of glory at Christmas. We have all sorts of songs about her, like I said, and certain faiths elevate Mary to a status that's probably beyond what she was meant to be, because she was chosen. Louise was right last week. Of course Mary is special. But I'm going to say to you, because Jesus had to come from a special line and be looked after and raised by a special man of the special line, Joseph was equally, if not more, important in the choice of parents for Jesus. And we forget that because he is not celebrated as much as Mary. So what did Mary do? She carried Jesus. Biologically carried him. And then she delivered him. But back in biblical times, the man was responsible for the family. He would raise the children in terms of discipline and teaching and education. Now, I am pleased that today that women are just as educated and just as involved in parenting as men were in biblical days. Do not think I'm criticizing that. But actually, there is something still in the story that says Joseph had to raise Jesus on a daily basis, teaching him not only trade and business and skills and social skills, working with the community, he actually had to teach him God's law. And we'll read more about that in a second. So son of David, that speaks of identity. What did Joseph hear? You are chosen because actually it's not a coincidence. I chose you. Special and chosen and for a reason. The second thing we heard was, or he heard, don't be afraid. Phew. Didn't Mary get told that last week? Yo, Mary, favored one, chosen one, don't be afraid. Well, it's the same kind of thing. Joseph, son of David, you're chosen, don't be afraid. And why is that? Because our human nature is to fear. And by the way, if we've got angels in the bedroom, or angels singing on high with trumpets, quite frankly, my reaction is going to be afraid. So is Mary, so is Joseph. God is almost smiling on the human reaction that he knows that both Mary and Joseph had. Do not be afraid. So what did Joseph hear? Reassurance. Straight away, you are called, not by accident, I've chosen you because of who you are, and it's going to be okay. But then, it goes on, of course, take Mary home. There's instruction. There's clarity. There's a call. There's a purpose to why Joseph has got an angel in the bedroom that night. There's a reason, and it's very, very important. And finally, significance. Joseph, your role is going to be one of huge significance because your son is the most significant human being to be born on earth. And I'm entrusting you, oh look, take Mary home, you are to give him. So that was like a parental reminder. You're going to be the dad here. The whole raising job, it's going to be yours, Joseph. You've got to do what every other man in the community does. As if he was your biological child, he's going to be your son in every practical way of influence. Hypocrisy is saying one thing and doing another. Integrity is actually doing the right thing, probably with no audience. After Joseph had decided not to stone Mary, then the angel appeared to him. He had made a judgment, a conscious moral decision to spare his fiancée's life. Then God said, I see your heart. I'm now going to give you the call to be this man of integrity that I know you already are. And so you've got this role model, Joseph, who before any sense of calling and in private was doing the right thing. To be called a righteous man, faithful to the law. He knew what God demanded and he was choosing to do it. Not just once in a blue moon and not just once when he had an audience. He did it time after time after time. And as we read some more passages in a second, I want you to spot that Joseph raised Jesus with integrity, regularly taking him to the temple as the law commanded. So Joseph's character is such an example to everybody here in the room, male and female. He had integrity. And my suggestion to you, like so many other biblical characters, is God saw it and chose him, knowing that he could carry the responsibility of raising Jesus. I don't know whether you've seen this week, I found it particularly moving. George H.W. Bush. Now, I am not into American politics. I am not trying to say everything this guy did was right, because I'm sure it wasn't, and there's sure there's all sorts of political ups and downs. But I watched probably 10 minutes of the highlights of his funeral, and I was ever so moved. In fact, Louise came into the room and I was crying. Now, I was crying for two reasons. Number one, I saw the front row of all the American living presidents all lined up. Some of you seen these images or seen these clips on the news? And I thought, wow, the power and influence in this room is unparalleled. There were British people there as well that were in government and stuff. But the influence, the responsibility on the shoulders of these men and women on the front row, and they're people I've grown up with. You know, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama. There was, what's Clinton's name? Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton. And there was Jimmy Carter. I remember him. See, he was the first president that I remember as a young boy. Ronald Reagan and Nancy, of course, both passed away. And on the other side was the son, George W. Bush, which confuses me because he was another president. But it was his address to the audience that really moved me. And George W. Bush said of his father, "My father showed me what it means to be a president that serves with integrity, leads with courage, and acts with love in his heart." And then his son broke down. And he cried in front of the world and in front of other presidents, he cried. Who cares about the title that George W. Bush used to lead America? And again, making some questionable decisions on the journey. But in that moment, he was honoring and saying goodbye to his father. Now, yes, that man, George H.W. Bush, was his biological father. But look at the way he praised him. It wasn't, "My father conceived me with my mother." That wasn't the honor that the son gave. It was, "Look, he showed me what integrity meant and what leading should be." And then the camera cuts to Mr. Trump. So what did Joseph hear? He heard that he was called on purpose, for a purpose, and that the responsibility would be life-consuming, and that he would need to continue being the man he already was. Take Mary. Do what you know you were planning to do, because you had your life planned out to be happy with this woman, to raise a family with this woman. Well, now I want to piggyback on your fantastic character of integrity, says God. Now you're going to just happen to raise my boy, called Jesus. No small challenge. Brené Brown, she's an American speaker about integrity and character. Let's just read this. "Integrity is choosing courage over comfort, choosing what is right over what is fun, fast, or easy, and choosing to practice our values rather than simply professing them." Wow, that's a good quote, isn't it? If I take one thing from today's thoughts about Joseph, maybe it should be that we need to be people of integrity. Not just in public, but in private, when God sees and nobody else sees. How about this one, C.S. Lewis? "Integrity is doing the right thing, even when no one is watching." That's what Joseph was before we even read that he was part of Jesus' family unit. Now, Luke chapter 2, verse 21 to 40. Let me read this to you. "On the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, he was named Jesus." There you are. Joseph made it happen, just as the angel said. "The name the angel had given him before he was conceived. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice, in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons." Let me just pause there. Once again, was he a man of integrity? Yes, doing the right thing, trying to be good in terms of how God expected him to treat his family. "Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. Moved by the Spirit, he went into the temple courts. When the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required, Simeon took him in his arms and praised God, saying, "Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of all the nations, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel." Joseph and Mary marveled at what they saw and heard. Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too." You referenced that passage last week, Louise, didn't you? There was also a prophet, Anna, the daughter of Penuel of the tribe of Asher. She was very old. She had lived with her husband 7 years, but was then a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple, but worshipped night and day, fasting and praying. Coming up to Joseph and Mary at that very moment, she gave thanks to God and spoke about the child to all who were looking forward to the redemption of Israel. When Joseph and Mary had done everything required by the law, there you go, integrity again, everything required by the law, they returned to Galilee, to their own town of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him. If you look at a number of biblical scholars and how they interpret that last paragraph, the child grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him. But scholars interpret that like this. Strength in biblical times was having a skill. Joseph was a carpenter. We read that in different passages that I'm not going to reference this morning. He was a carpenter. He had firm, rough hands. He would have had strong muscles. And he transferred those skills and abilities to his son. You see, Joseph's mandate that the angel gave him, take Mary home and basically be the father of the most important human being, Joseph taught him, raised him, gave him skills, and didn't let him do like Joseph in the Old Testament with the coat of many colors, where he was the favorite and he did nothing and the brothers resented him. Remember that story? This Joseph, father of Jesus, Joseph said, "Sorry, roll up your sleeve, you're going to learn how to handle wood. Get that chisel, boy." He would have done as his father had instructed, and his father was diligent to raise him intellectually and physically. Joseph was a caring and consistent father. He was doing the right thing. So what did Joseph see in this encounter? He saw this chap, Simeon. And Simeon was waiting for a very long time. Simeon had been promised something by God. "You're not going to die until you see my Messiah." And in this moment where Simeon grabs him, it reminds me of the Lion King. You know the scene if you've seen the movie. Picks up the baby and thrusts this baby into the sky and goes, "Here he is!" And Joseph, the dad, watches a man of God who's given his entire life waiting, waiting, and waiting. And what does Joseph see? He sees God's timing. He sees that God does not do things at our speed, but God takes his time. And when the time is right and when the people are right, God moves. That's what Joseph saw in Simeon. Not an insignificant thing, because Simeon's life was dedicated waiting to see the Messiah, a life of calling. What else did he see? This statement, everything required by the law, he had to be doing the obedient thing with his family for Simeon, who was also prompted by the Holy Spirit, to go to the temple and meet them. If Joseph had not done the right thing, would Simeon have met Jesus as a baby? No. Because the Holy Spirit prompted Simeon to go to the temple, because Joseph, who is the man of integrity, did the right thing by bringing Jesus to the temple. If either of those two things did not happen, the prophecy would not have actually been fulfilled, and Simeon would have died without God's promise being fulfilled. What else did we see? Well, that lovely sentence that Simeon has seen your salvation. Joseph saw in the eyes of someone who probably were very teary-eyed. I can't imagine Simeon going, "Okay, God, you can kill me now." I think Simeon would have been beside himself with emotion. His entire life he'd been waiting for this moment. And here it is, right now. And Joseph had to just watch his son be embraced by a man waiting for him. What an incredible thing to see. Can you use your imagination? My son being embraced by someone who's waiting for the Messiah. And now the final sentence by Simeon was, "Now you may dismiss your servant." It means, "I'm happy to die now, God. My life is, it can't get any better than this. So when it's time, you take me, God, because I'm not waiting for anything else. My life will never be more precious and special than this moment. I'm ready to go." What an incredible thing to hear someone else say. And Joseph saw it. I'd like to suggest to us that one of the most powerful things in life is people who reveal and tell their own story. Simeon's story became inspirational to Joseph and Mary. In watching someone else's life unfold, in watching his patience and his dedication, his consistency in following God, what an incredible testimony to Joseph and Mary, who were younger, of course, than Simeon. How often are we willing to be vulnerable or honest and tell our story so that someone else can be encouraged? It's just a thought. This week, something strange happened. Never happened to me before. I was doing some homework marking in school. I had a lesson free, which is a nice, rare situation, but I had a lesson free and I was doing some marking. And the phone rang in the office and I answered it. And it was the lady here down in reception. And she said, "Steve, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm marking." "No, no, no, someone's ill. You need to go right now." And I was already 5 minutes late because I didn't know that I had to be teaching, okay? So I burst into a completely new, it was maths, which is why I could obviously make it happen. But I turned up and I just went, "Hello, guys. Right, what have you been learning?" And of course, it's just think on your feet, really, at that point. And within 2 minutes, I had my trusty USB stick and I pulled up my slides from last year and off we went and they had a great lesson. Part of that lesson, with students I've not really met before, I knew a couple of them, but I didn't know their names. And I basically introduced, my opening story was about probability and it was a slide with Dalmatian dogs on. And I talked about the probability of male and female Dalmatians breeding brown-spotted puppies versus black-spotted puppies. And the kids were like, you know, their mouths were open going, "How is this maths? But the story is brilliant." And at that moment, I had them. I don't care who they were. Their behavior was great, by the way. But from that moment on, and then I told them the story of our own dog, who was the only black-spotted puppy in the litter of brown spots. Totally true. So I was willing to share something of my life, which some teachers, by the way, do not share. And I'm not criticizing that. It's just, you know, some people go, whoa, I am not telling a student whether I'm married or single or what I did on the weekend. I'm not telling them anything about my life. I'm the opposite. I probably tell them too much about my life so that when students go through the park in Mitchell Dean, if Louise is walking to Mrs. Jones, they know Louise. Yeah, because I filmed her. And then I showed these students, I showed them a video of us on holiday, and they were like, "Okay, we are getting to know quite a lot about Mr. Jones in a swimming pool." So basically, I was willing to share something of the truth of my life, and then I linked it to math, so it was poignant. Those students were completely enthralled by me just sharing that little bit and showing them a holiday video. And at the end of the lesson, I couldn't get rid of them because it was break time. I'm like, "Off you go." And they were like, no, we love this. Could you be our teacher?" Okay, we're not going to have that conversation. You've got a good math teacher. And they do. They have a great math teacher. But if they have a teacher who doesn't do that, who doesn't share the personal nature of their life. My question to you is, how much do we share and encourage each other through not only our successes, but our mistakes as well? When we are honest, we can learn so, so much from each other. Even if it's how not to do something. How many young people are fumbling their way through life, not a clue, and having very little input from anyone else willing to share their mistakes or their successful decisions? I promise you, young people are desperate for input. They're desperate. They are. And more than the right number of people are withholding the experience and the wisdom they have. Did Joseph do that? No. Joseph imparted everything, physically, mentally, spiritually, into his boy. And I believe we are called to do the same to each other and especially to the upcoming generations who are desperate for guidance. They might not say it. They might say, "Pop off, I don't want your advice." But I promise you, they want it. They do. They want it in relationship and honesty. They don't want you to go and bash them and order them around. Of course they don't. But they're desperate for input. So what did Joseph see? He saw God's faithfulness. And finally, last passage. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. Hang on, let's not gloss over that. Was Joseph the man of integrity? Did he go to the festival once when someone was watching, or did he do it every year? Consistency, guys. Consistency. What an incredible man of integrity and consistency. When Jesus was 12 years old, they went to the festival according to the custom, doing what was the right thing to do. After the festival was over, whilst his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But they were unaware of it. This is quite funny as a parent, isn't it? Thinking he was in their company, they travelled on for a whole day. So, yeah, Jesus is around somewhere. He's back there with the cousins. Then they began looking for him, going, has anyone got Jesus? He's kind of vanished. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem a whole day. Jesus has been on his own, age 12 years old, in Jerusalem for 2 days at least. At least 2 days. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting amongst the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. 12 years old. Listening, conversing, socializing, questioning them, and giving answers at 12 years old. Is that a coincidence that Jesus just woke up one morning and had a spiritual USB plug put into his brain so that the knowledge was transferred instantly? No. Is that a sign of a fantastic godly upbringing? Yes. And I don't mean to disrespect Mary because she was chosen, but Joseph would have been the one to have put in that education into him. That does not happen overnight. It's consistency, as we said. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding at 12 years old and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." "Why were you searching for me?" he asked. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and with man. Jesus continued to grow mentally with wisdom, with all of that input that Joseph put into him. Let's not super spiritualize this. Joseph and Mary raised Jesus. They did. They introduced him to the scriptures that they had, to the traditions, to the religious law, what God wanted. They introduced all that into him. Jesus wasn't born pre-programmed. He was a blank sheet of paper like I believe every other child is born. And they are then a reflection of what is put into them year after year. Let me show you a funny picture. Oh. For those that don't know, the girl on the left is now 21. She was 21 this week. It was her birthday, and she's off at university causing chaos. And that's obviously my son, Thomas. How old do you think he was there, Lou? 3, 4, maybe? 2-ish, 3-ish. What you might not know is we lost Thomas at that age. We did. We were on a family holiday. I think it was in Wales. We bumped into my cousins who were also there in Wales, and we went to the beach for a day. And it was a nice sunny day, and you know, you build sandcastles and do all of that stuff. It was lovely. And Louise and I must have been talking or doing something with Beth, I don't know. We turned around and Thomas wasn't there. But we thought, it's okay, just like the passage, my cousins have probably got him. Because my cousins had children and they were all playing together and they were probably over, you know, a couple of meters away over there. And so just like the passage where you've got Mary and Joseph said, well, he's probably with all the family and friends. That's kind of what we felt. And we were like, yeah, he's with my cousin, he's fine. And then we go over there and go, have you got Thomas? And he's like, we thought he was with you. That sentence, I can tell you as a parent, breeds shock and fear. We thought he was with you. How long was he lost, do you think?
Probably about five, six minutes.
Yeah. Maybe. It might as well have been 5 or 6 hours. Because the beach was not an empty beach where you could see for, you know, hundreds of meters. It was a very, very busy, packed with holidaymakers, sunny summer beach scene. And as you looked around, there were people and dogs and, you know, everywhere. So what rapidly happened was, search party! And so we all split up. You know, Louise grabbed Beth and went over there, and I went over there, and my cousins went over there, 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 and there. And we did find him, because he'd just done exactly what Jesus had done. Not quite the same spiritual call, I have to say. But Thomas had decided, I'm going for a walk. And this, what's wrong with this? I'm going to go over here. Oh, look, there's some children. I'm going to go and play with them. Understandably for that kind of age, okay. Now, I'm smiling, and I'm telling you this story so that you can hopefully put yourself in the shoes of Joseph and Mary. Not just 6 minutes he'd been lost for, but a day. We'd gone on, we'd travelled with our entire caravan for a whole day. And now it's going to take a whole day to get back. Where is my 12-year-old boy? What we find, and this is important, is this. Jesus says to them, well, there's no reason to be stressed. Stop stressing, Mum, it's all fine. Didn't you know that I had to be in my Father's house? And when we ask the question, do you know what I know at Christmas time? What would Joseph have known? Well, after this event, he would have known where to find Jesus. Where was Jesus? In his Father's company. And where I want to finish our thoughts today as we look at Joseph is that very simple question. Do you know where to find Jesus? Because his mum and his dad, earthly mum and dad, had to know, and they had to probably learn from their 12-year-old, why did you not know that I was in the presence of my Father, talking about him, conversing, challenging, exchanging with people who are very intelligent about my Father? Oh, I want to find out more about God. That's, of course, where I'm going to be, in the temple. And the question I just want us to stop and think about, this idea of where is Jesus, I hear a lot of well-meaning drivel today. Gooey nonsense that comes around not only at Christmas but every day of the year about I find Jesus in my plant. Really? You're finding Jesus in your plant? Okay, right. And you've got other people, I find Jesus in my children. You find Jesus in your children? I think what they're trying to say is that they see images of God in nature. I agree. I'm a big, big fan of looking at what God has made and giving him thanks for it. I really am. Scenery and the amazing world around us, whether it's natural world, whether it's mountains and rivers and everything. Look at some of the satellite images of our planet from space. It brings me to tears. But that's not because Jesus lives there. It's because God has made it and it's a pointer. These things are pointers to God the Father and pointers to Jesus and pointers to the Holy Spirit and what they did together and are doing together as a Trinity. But Jesus is not in the plant. Jesus is not in my dog. Jesus is not in my children. Jesus is in heaven right now. And you might think, why is Steve saying this? Because Jesus is a man in bodily form. And where we wrap up this talk is that Jesus came to become a man, to have to be taught and educated like a man by his earthly father, Joseph, who treated him like a biological son, raised him as if he was in the line of David to all intents and purposes. But Jesus right now is in heaven. Why? Because after Joseph died, and all we know is that he died at some point before Jesus went to the cross, the Emmanuel that we sang about 25 minutes ago is what Christmas is all about. God came to be with us, but Jesus died and is now seated at the right hand of the Father, waiting for us to join him. The evidence of God is in our world. Please don't misunderstand me. Evidence of God is all around us. But Jesus, in bodily form, is waiting. He's prepared a place for us. And that's what we have to conclude with. Joseph was a faithful, diligent man, called. He saw things, he heard things, he knew things. And if we can grasp it, wow, our Christmas will be transformed because of Emmanuel. So we're going to sing, Do You See What I See? You know what I mean? Do you hear what I hear? Do you know what I know? Emmanuel! Can you see why we attached that other song on the back end? Because you've got question one, question two, question three, answer. The answer to all those questions. Emmanuel, Emmanuel, God is with us. Jesus is waiting for us. Jesus' life did not finish when he was born. He obviously went on to this, these stories we've read this morning, and he then carried on into adulthood and ministry and ultimately died for us. Why? So that we could be with him.